In a few minutes, I'm going to ask you to participate in what I'm going to be doing this morning with me. I'll make it very, very clear. I'm going to hold up some signs, and if I hold up signs to your section, notice that we're divided into four sections here, just the people in that section say what it says, okay? And I'll run around and get other people involved as time goes on. As you can see, things are a little different this morning than usual. I'm not doing readings at the beginning of the sermon, and I'm setting up what we're going to do in just a moment. As Unitarian Universalists, we have historically claimed many sources in support of our religious way of life. The wisdom blossoming in the world's garden of religions and cultures, unique individual experiences of depth and questioning, our sense of connection to the forces of the cosmos, which are greater than we are, and humanistic critique of claims made by sheer self-anointed authority alone. Yet, I have to face that every week I am called a minister, not a shaman, not a high priest, or a professor of philosophy. I have to face that we meet on Sundays, not at Friday noon, or sometime when the moon is either full or new. We use a format surrounding a sermon, and we meet in a building that, although the architect named it a worship center, is most often called a church by people when they say, I'm going down to the church. They don't say, I'm going down to the worship center. We do not walk around a reliquary of the Buddha or offer incense in a temple privately. We meet in community, and we have membership in that community. And besides using the Christian words Christmas and Easter, we also offer a Seder, I chant Kol Nidre, and I call my one day off every week, admittedly Monday, not Saturday, a Sabbath. Our root traditions, Judaism and Christianity, are not hidden away. They are not minor. Our history flows out of them, and they are visible through and through. And so this morning I want to do what the Jews call a midrash, that is, telling a new story to help us see an older story in a new way. But before that, just a bit of history to lay the groundwork, first from American history, and then from Jewish history, and finally, the telling of a Christian story. First, the sad affair of the Bacon Rebellion in 1674 in Virginia. And I've told this story a number of times, but I'm going to keep on repeating it because I never heard this when I was growing up in any history class that I ever had. And so I think we might have to do catch-up here in order to make this part of our understanding of our own history. In 1674, black and white indentured servants joined together to foment a rebellion against Virginia's governors and the plantation owners, who would not listen to their needs and their fears, some of which I admit were based on some foolish notions. Nevertheless, when the rebellion was quelled, the Virginia upper classes realized that if they could get poor indentured servants of their colony, black and white, to fight against each other instead of them, then they would have it made. Most historians date the beginning of what we now call racism in this country to that singular event in 1674. It was only after this time that African Americans were forbidden by law to marry Euro-Americans, white people. That word hadn't even been invented yet, by the way. Or to own property, forbidden to own property. The second story is about Pontius Pilatus, whom we usually call in English in English, Pontius Pilate. He was an historical Roman whom we know from archaeological finds, as you can see on the cover of your order of celebration, as well as from several ancient historians. Two Jewish historians, Philo Judaeus and Flavius Josephus, both tell a version of this same story I'm going to tell you, and they're very, very close in their telling of the story. So historians accept this as something that really happened. When Pilatus first came to Caesarea on the seacoast of the Mediterranean in the year 26, he sent the troops who sailed with him on inland to Jerusalem, while he stayed on by the sea. Under cover of night, the soldiers put up votive shields on the barracks walls that faced the interior of the temple, shields asserting the divinity of the emperor Tiberius. Since no Jew could accept the idea of a human being as a god, and please note that historically Unitarians and Universalists have always felt exactly the same way, no human being is a god, they petitioned the commandant in the barracks to take the provocative votive shields down. He refused. So they took their complaint to his boss. This took a lot of effort on their part. Upwards of 3,000 people marched for 3 full days up to Caesarea to take their beef up with Pilatus himself. Pilatus was angry and at first refused to talk with them. So they protested. In one version, it was a silent protest. They just simply sat down on the ground and refused to move. Another version of the story says it was a noisier protest, perhaps something like the protests we might remember from the 60s if we're that old, or the present State House protests. In any case, after some 5 days, the new prefect herded all of them into the stadium and then surrounded them, according to Josephus, 3 soldiers deep with their swords drawn. Pilatus then told them, "Go back to the city, business as usual, or I'll have you all killed right now." They swiftly conferred, the people in the hippodrome, and they fell to the ground, and they threw back their cowls and bared their necks. And they said, "We would rather die than give up our Torah principles that no human being is a god." Pilatus was unprepared for such a demonstration of freedom and courage, and prudently, he was unwilling to kill 3,000 people at the beginning of his tenure. So he had the votive shields taken down. As you can well imagine, this story made the rounds, and within a few days, there was hardly a person from the border of Syria all the way down to the border of Egypt who had not heard this tale of a powerful Roman official getting his comeuppance from common folks banding together to take a stand on their beloved principle with their shared power. In a moment, you will hear a passion play based on the 4 Gospels, certainly, based on critique of the 4 Gospels by modern critics, and based on the stories I just told, which form a midrash on the actual telling of the Passion in the Gospels, a story commenting on a story.
And so they left the supper table and left the city and walked across the Kidron Ravine and came to the Garden of the Olive Press. When they arrived at the garden, they entered through the gate. Jesus said to his students,
"Stay here and keep watch. I'm going over there to pray."
So he took with him Peter, Jacob, John, and Mary of Magdala. He told them to wait nearby while he went further into the grove. He threw himself on the ground and began to cry out,
"Oh, if only I didn't have to go through this. If only I could avoid this terrible time."
He went back to find his students sound asleep as it was late. He said to them,
"Best wake up now. I hear someone coming."
At that moment, a whole band of temple police and soldiers came up into the garden, their way lit by lanterns and torches. They were being led by his student Judas, who had told them that he would identify Jesus in the dark by kissing him in ordinary greeting. Judas came right up to Jesus and kissed him. Immediately, they arrested him. Peter, however, reacted. He suddenly drew his sword and slashed at the ear of one of the bystanders. But Jesus turned and said to Peter,
"Stop it, Peter. Put down your sword. Don't you know that people who use the sword often die by the sword?"
Peter dropped the sword and ran off. So did the other students, but no one chased them. They had the man they wanted. Then Jesus turned to the arresting officer and said,
"For weeks now, I have been teaching openly throughout the city and in the temple. Why didn't you arrest me then if you thought I was doing something wrong? How strange that you come only after me now under the cover of darkness."
So they manacled him and took him to the villa of the former ranking priest in the city, Annas, the father-in-law of the invested priest, Caiaphas. Peter and Mary of Magdala followed at some safe distance. She was known to the priestly family and so was able to get them entrance into the courtyard. Annas interrogated Jesus, demanding to know about his controversial teachings. But Jesus interrupted him.
"I've been teaching for weeks in the temple. Everything I do is right out in the open. I have no secrets. I do not have hidden messages. So why are you treating me like some low-life conspirator? Why don't you just question everyone who's been listening to my sermons? They'll confirm everything I've said."
One of the officers standing there slapped him across the face, saying,
"How dare you address a man of his standing with such rudeness?"
But Jesus simply turned his red cheek away from the seething officer and muttered,
"If I have been lying, it's up to you to prove it. But I was just telling the simple truth. So why does that deserve a slap?"
Meanwhile, Peter was warming himself by a charcoal fire. One of the bystanders noticed him and said,
"You know what? I think I saw you there in the garden tonight. You're one of that man's friends."
"I am not. I don't even know what you're talking about. I never met him."
"But I'm sure I saw you. You're even talking with his accent."
"I tell you, I don't know what you're talking about. Just leave me alone."
"No, now I am sure you are with him."
"Leave me alone, damn it. I tell you, I have never met him. I don't know him, and if I did, I know I wouldn't like him. Now go away."
At that moment, a rooster crowed, announcing the dawn, and then it crowed again. Peter came to his senses and realized what he had just done. So he got up and ran out of the villa gate and found a private place where he sobbed without consolation. Meanwhile, after a brief interview with Caiaphas, the current ranking priest, the soldiers took the man to the prefect of all Judea, Pontius Pilatus. It was early morning at the governor's quarters. Pilatus read the charges leveled against Jesus. First, disturbing the peace. Second, questioning the right of the Romans to exact taxes. Third, preaching about the rule of love instead of the rule of Caesar. So the prefect, had the prisoner brought to him. He said to Jesus,
"What nonsense is this? So, do you think you're greater than Caesar himself? Do you think you should be in charge? Do you think you're some sort of king?"
"Is this what people are saying about me now?"
"What people are saying about you is that you're disturbing the peace and calling into question the authorities. And your preaching seems to be effective. There has already been one riot this week led by a man also named Jesus. Jesus Barabbas." "Oh, don't give me that look. We know he's not one of your students. But quelling the riot he led cost my people lives, and I might add, your people's lives as well. Frankly, I don't see a reason why either of you should live. You're both dangerous. Him with his swords, you with your words pitting love against our clear authority. Both of you, in your own way, question our lawful rule, the rule of my people over your people. Therefore, both of you will go to the cross."
As he signed the writ of execution for both men, he suddenly got an idea. Pilatus, who was always scheming to get something for nothing, came up with a ploy. If he could get the students of Jesus of Galilee to rival and quarrel with the ruffians led by Jesus Barabba, then they would both leave the Roman occupiers alone, and they would confine their hatred to each other. This would solve a lot of problems. Knowing undeniably that followers of both men were outside the court awaiting the outcome, he told his recruits to bring the two prisoners out to the balcony, and then he went out and spoke to the small early morning crowd that had gathered.
"I am feeling generous today. I have decided, since your Passover, your so-called Feast of Freedom is coming up, to set free one of the prisoners we have arrested this week. So, who would you like me to release to you? Jesus the Galilean or Jesus Barabba?"
This gesture was so untypical of Pilatus that people at first did not know what to do and were silent. But soon, the followers of Barabba cried out, "Free Barabba! Barabba. Free Barabba. Barabba!" When Mary of Magdala and Peter heard this, they were horrified. At first, they felt panicked and defeated. But then the Magdalene said to Peter,
"Remember what happened when Pilatus arrived in our land and the assembly who confronted him made him change his mind? That can work again. There are thousands of Galileans in town for Passover, camped over the hill. Many of them are not 2 minutes from here, camped just outside. There is John, there is Andrew, and there is Jacob over there. Why not send them to gather our friends?"
Peter agreed, and his friends ran out to the fields to bring in more people. Within minutes, more and more people gathered until a huge multitude had assembled. The comrades of Barabba continued to chant, "Free Barabba! Free Barabba!" But Mary of Magdala and Peter had begun to chant,
Free the Galilean! Free the Galilean!
And as more and more people came to the pavement under the balcony, they chanted with many voices, Free the Galilean! Free the Galilean!
Free the Galilean!
Then they just started to chant, "Free him! Free him now! Free him now!
Free him now!
Free him now!" Pilatus estimated 3,000 people there in front of him and knew he had to reconsider, since this was just before Passover. So he took the writ of executions for both men and said,
"What I have written, I can tear up."
Barabba, who had killed in the riot, was put back into jail for consideration on another day, but the Galilean was released into the waiting arms of his students. 4 decades later, Peter, Mary of Magdala, and Jesus were sitting by the lake near Bethsaida, watching the sun set on the day and also in some ways on their lives. Their bones ached with the work of a lifetime, the teaching that they had spread through the land, even as far as Rome. Yet, as they remembered that awful day when the teacher had almost been crucified, they took a deep breath together, grateful for their present lives, grateful for the love and friendship they shared, grateful for a world made better by freedom, courage, faithfulness, love.
After all, the center of our tradition is not a building, however beautiful, not a city, however grand, but love and courage in the hearts of human beings. Human beings joined together in freedom to sow the seeds of justice that will blossom come the spring of the new world.
I don't have power over the weather. When I speak, the tornadoes don't turn away. The death-dealing storms don't vanish. And I have no power over earthquakes, neither do you. But personally, I don't believe in a God called fate, who controls all life without regard to any of us, who runs all of us under a steamroller, saying, some of you, because of who you are and what you look like, can have jobs, can have joy, can have justice. Others, the rest of you, as a matter of fact, can just have injustice and misery for the rest of your days. Just as I worship no human being as God, I do not worship fate as God. We can't stop hail from falling out of the sky, but we can stop people who claim power for themselves and themselves alone from hurting people who have forgotten their power. We can work with others who may not look like us or believe like us theologically, but who share our sense of fairness. Like Swimmy and the children's story this morning, we can come together to chase away things that might wish to devour us for their own gain. Now, I'm very well aware that historically Jesus didn't escape the cross. And I also know that many that I love very dearly are very comfortable in their conviction that his suffering was necessary and good. But I stand in a living tradition and claim a living tradition that for hundreds and hundreds of years has not been able to agree with that assertion. I personally do not think that the suffering of innocent or misrepresented people has anything good in it at all. And I really don't care whether we're talking about an ancient Galilean teacher who was very wise, or a woman who dies for lack of accessible health treatment or health information, dies of diabetes, easily reversed, or of a high school truant from a local school who's missing out on an education, or of a young man down the street killed by a bullet in a drive-by shooting. All of their suffering has no redemptive good in it. The bread meeting at Veterans Memorial in 2 weeks on the 2nd of May that you heard about earlier is an action based upon this principle that no human being should have godlike power over any other human being, and that people have to work together to get anything done at all that's worth doing. Today, I wanted to show that it's not the first time in history that such things have happened. People have gathered for justice, refusing to rival and compete with each other and joining together instead. I wanted to show that working with large numbers of people means something, something powerful, and that to claim freedom as our own, which we often do around here, means that we are called to love others enough to courageously show up to demand freedom for everyone else as well.